Okay, Jared, thank you very much. And it's a pleasure to be served twice, because I've been served once as a dish of the day or experimentalist of the week by Leon Balanz maybe 10 years ago, when I talk and about cuprates and manganese and that kind of whole thing. And now I'm back. Okay, so thank you so much for inviting, and that's a fantastic place to be here by any chance. Hopefully I'll tell you today something interesting and exciting. And one of the most exotic things here is perhaps then I'll be talking about something that has no spin orbit, but as a real atomic thing. And yet it will serve the physics, which is very relevant to spin orbit interaction in atomic sense. Okay. So I may not cover everything what I want to cover, but there is a one big topic which is very dear to my heart, is the frustrated systems. We are very good these days, seems to me, in designing highly frustrated systems like two-dimensional kagamis and two-dimensional triangular lattices. So if anybody has good ideas and interest in this kind of physics, so I would be very happy to talk to a theorist about that. Okay, and just to say, I'm a pure experimentalist, and I don't do any theory, so whatever I say about theories just should be taken with a grain of salt. Okay, so what I would say is perhaps what reflects my talk best is this quote from Marcel Proust, where I'm not a chemist. I'm not going to show to you, here's the new chemical materials, which is very hot material, and let's do that all together. So we physicists don't do that. So what do? We say, well, it sort of reflects what the physicists do. The real voyage of discovery consists of not in seeking new landscapes, like new materials, but in having new eyes. So we take the existing stuff, what inorganic chemists typically deliver us with all this beauty, and then we try to do something interesting. So let's see what we can do. Okay, so what we do is in my lab, we synthesize this new artificial quantum materials by pulse laser deposition and oxide MBE. We have a small solid state synthesis effort. I'm not pretending to be any good inorganic chemist at all. What differentiates us from many, many other groups around the world is that by my training, I'm a spectroscopist. I'm not a grower. And so we do a lot of in situ photoelectron spectroscopy. And so we know exactly what happens when we grow the material. And at the same time, what I am is really like is here is that we do a lot of synchrotron work, and today I'm going to be talking about a lot of synchrotron probes. We have been doing it for many, many years, this absorption spectroscopy, magnetic spectroscopy, XMCD. We, in the past few years, moved the resonance scattering, and I will show the very first results you can get from inelastic resonance scattering, when we can look at the excitations. Okay, so this is where we are now. So. And we love to collaborate with other groups on props, device, and the theory. Whoever has any ideas, please feel free. Okay, so what we do in my lab, this is the scope, those are buzzwords. We're typically very good for funding agencies. But it does reflect partially what my postdocs and PhDs are focused on. We started working very, very actively on trying to improve high-TC superconductors by making heterostructures of those, trying to discover new superconductors based on nickelates. So this is one of the efforts we're still working on that very aggressively. Another area we are very, very interested is that what I said, we're interested in topological materials, on topological phases, but without explicit spin orbits. So these spin orbit, it will be either the virtual interaction, or it should this phenomenon should occur out of interactions. We're very, very active now in the field of the time domain spectroscopy, ultra-fast phenomena, and trying to find hidden phases which sort of metastable and would not exist otherwise if you adiabatically try to reach those. This is the newest area where I think we have very good materials progress. We not finally learn how to design true frustrated lattices, true kagamis and true triangular lattices, and we could have reasonable choice of ions you can place on those lattices. So it's there now. And we have an active effort on iridates and rhodates, and that's sort of like a true spin orbit thing. And but it's sort of a separate topic to talk what is the interesting physics in those materials. Okay, that's sort of briefly sort of say. Okay, let me begin with the point of view of a physicist versus chemist on the material phases. Those are all interesting materials which sort of fed us with wonderful physics throughout the years. If you look at this particular axis here, this is the phase, different colors, different phases, a lot of exotics here, exciting physics. But what controls those phases is typically very, very limited. This material either will be controlled by doping, like in cuprates, or pnictites, or manganites, or pressure, or magnetic field, and this is pressure again. So basically three things. That's what is being offered in the bulk materials and by chemists to reach all these fantastic phases. But is there any more in those materials? Of course there are more, but the question is how can you reach something interesting which is not covered by the pressure, doping, or magnetic field? And for that reason, I'll show it to you what chemists do. The chemists do this kind of things. And for those of you who are not in the chemistry, not familiar with the term polymorphs, the polymorphs are the materials with the same chemical formula, the same chemical elements, but the different lattice symmetry. So you can have iridates, for example, it being hexagonal or perovskite, and that's sort of the example of polymorph. So under pressure of, say, 40 kilobar, it becomes a perovskite. So that's a different polymorph of strontium iridate. Okay, those are the what we do as physicists. We try to improve or reach new grounds from the bulk materials. And this is sort of shows the correspondence, what physicists do as opposed to chemistry. So we, of course, would utilize the interface to the charge transfer. We can do electrostatic gating. That's our analogy to doping. Instead of pressure, we can apply a strain. It's not the same, absolutely, by no means, but it's similar. We can also apply magnetic field, of course. But what's special here is this. We can do polymorphs by hand. We actually could design these lattices if you clever layer your materials. And there are a couple of things you could never do in the bulk. Of course, you cannot do quantum confinement. And otherwise, it's not a bulk. And of course, you can do the physics of interfaces. Of course, you can have surfaces, right? But that's only a very, very private case of the interfaces. All right. So what's special about the way we reach those phases is, for example, the interface has been very, very popular tool for the past maybe 10 years. And this is like sort of the summary what you can do in the interfaces. With interfaces, so this is the sort of like old case, but which is very, very well studied by now. This is the when we merge the high TC superconductor, yttrium, barium, copper, O7, with slightly modified to optimal doping, with some CMR manganite here, and there are a lot of interesting things that can occur at the interface, because interface will break all sort of symmetries. And if you're a little bit familiar with Landau, you will immediately realize that's actually a very good thing. Because once you break the symmetry of certain order parameters, then it's a good thing. So the new phase may appear. And so for example, the interface would have a spin frustration where the incompatible order parameters and magnetism will occur, and that somehow needs to be resolved. There is, of course, charge frustration here. So if you go through, there's a typically dipolar charge jump when you go across the interface. And there will be some built-in dipolar fields, which will arrange atoms and physics. There is, of course, orbital frustration. And that's how the orbitals, active orbitals, will look in the cuprates. And that's how they look in the manganites. So the interesting question is what happened in the interface. And of course, there is a chemical frustration because the ions, so this is actually a chemical map of this interface from Eales. You can see that those are ions and they see at the right end interface a very different chemical environment, different bonding, and so on. So, what we hope here when the game started is to find the new quantum phases, new energy scales, or new energy, new Lenz scales. Okay, but in addition to this, I'd like to sort of address something which is quite new, and And this is the game which we just recently started. Can we just design the lattices or modify certain structural aspects of the lattices so we can create brand new mod phases? In other words, I'll show the example. What if we can control phonons? Okay. What kind of physics can you gain if you can control structural degrees of freedom? And another thing which I'll address today, which is relevant to the spin orbit, is the artificial 2D polymorphs. So remember, this is the same chemical formula, but the different lattice. And so what we can do now, we can design these new polymorphs by starting from the 3D mod crystals like this, and then we turn them into the hexagonal lattices. Okay? And we can just layer perfect hexagonal structures with basically almost arbitrary choice of ions at the hexagon, either with the spin orbit or without the spin orbit, either correlated or non-correlated. Okay. And that's number one. The number two, what we've been working as well, we can make those structures now, the true atomic planes of Kagamis, true atomic planes of triangular lattices. Again, starting with the particular structures. Because by modern layering methods of growth allows you to create this kind of geometries. And so what we do, we'll be using surface as a template and then force the particular growth, okay, in a particular direction, a particular lattice structure. Okay, so as I said, I'm afraid I wouldn't have time to talk about this, but I would be more than happy to discuss with whoever wants to hear this part of the story, but I hope to cover this for sure. Okay, so the first thing I would like to show, and again, what I'm going to be showing today is absolutely brand new. It's either not published or it's just appeared in press. So, because I think the theorist needs to see what's really latest and greatest. And so what I'd like to show to you is the first known to me case of the purely electronic mod metal insulator transition in the complex oxides. So pure mod electronic transition means that there would be no lattice degrees involved when you grow through MIT. MIT is metal insulator transition. In other words, lattice symmetry remains the same throughout the whole thing. And the whole phenomena will be like in a textbook from mod, right? So about the MIT. Okay, so it's a pure, it's a, you're basically a Hubbert Hamiltonian in action, no structure. Okay, so allow me to start with that, and by the way, stop me anytime you'd like to hear something else, if something in this place. So I'll start with this nickelates, and the rarest nickelates has been around for quite a while, but the interest in those materials perhaps re-emerged when Kaliulin's group was proposing how to make a high TC superconductor out of nickelates, and so it's become basically a very, very active field. And so we also got in this game about around 2007.
I mean, just a comment maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know if I have encyclopedic knowledge, for sure not, but it seems like there are some bulk systems that have metal insulator transitions that are oxides that don't show any structural change, like at least there, I know some pyroclores, cadmium osmate does this.
Right, but yes, yeah, I'll comment on that.
It's an oxide, it's got oxygen.
Leon, I'll absolutely, there are constraints to what I say, right? So there will be a slide, and which way will just, you and I could comment both, right? So I agree, very generically saying this is not the case, right? It's not fair, right? So I'll list these cases, but I'll say something about those, okay? So, okay. So let's go with that. And maybe I'm missing something. I would be more than happy to see the systems because I don't want the singular case, right? So the singular case means something is wrong. Okay, so the nickelates in the bulk, they're very, very simple. This is the chemical formula. This is it's a rarest ion sitting here from lanthanum to lutetium. And this is how the metallic phase would look like. In the metallic phase, they all are atrombic. Pretty simple. All the nickels equivalent in this within atrombic unit cells, so there are non-equivalent nickels here. And if you just simply do the ion count, it's very, very simple. It's nickel 3+, People would say, okay, Euclid's 3d7, and you could try to play this game and say, okay, well, perhaps it's a low spin system, so it's one of the possible configurations, at least looks reasonable. So there is a single EG electron, and that was the first problem here, because if that's the case, that's a Jahn-Teller reactive system, so what happens? Where is the Jahn-Teller effect in that? And I'm going to say that people tried very, very hard. There is no Jahn-Teller distortion in the system whatsoever. So there should be some other way to unload this electron, because the degeneracy is non-tolerable. And that was the first puzzle people struggled. But that's the phase diagram after Jude and Goodenough. And so what we see here is the ionic radius when you go from here, least distorted. It's all boring thing. It's a paramagnetic electromagnetic metal all the way through in lanthanum nucleate. But once you hit a little bit of a distortion, say for example in the praseodymium or neodymium, there's a metal to insulating transition. And that's sort of like final answer. So people found antiferromagnetism, at least they say. They claim it's a monoclinic, and of course an insulator here, and it's a first order transition all the way here on this line. And if you go to the more distorted members here, all of a sudden something new appears here. There will be paramagnetic phase, also insulating, with monoclinic lattice symmetry. But if you can keep cooling in temperature, the charge order and the E prime antiferromagnetism will set in. That's all in the bulk, by the way.
But does it imply that the 4F electrons don't do anything?
It does imply that there are 4F electrons not doing anything. It needs to be considered case by case, right? For example, it depends what you. If you look at the some of them silent, some of them magnetic. That's true. You know.
But they never order.
Yeah, they do. They do, of course, in at low temperatures, like about 10, 15, 20 Kelvin, because it's a gradual thing, right? And so, absolutely. Yeah, some of them silent, right? So, but some of them quite active, right? Europium titanate is an example, right? Classic case. Okay. All right, so I'm going to be talking today about those three things. And so this is first sort of shocker when the Sawatsky, Komsky, and Mizukawa just came to a conclusion that actually is wrong. And the main reason for that, this compound is not really like Mott-Hoover type. It's actually charge transfer material, meaning the oxygen band is next to the firm edge, right? Just right below. It's not DD transition, which is low energy excitation between the lower and upper Hoover band, but that's between the P band for the oxygen and the D band, which is above firm edge, okay? So, and as such, this configuration is incorrect, and if I start moving my electron across the crystal, just to look at how the transport occurs, then should be considered not D7, but actually D8 with ligand hold. It's exactly like it would be looking at Zangreis state and cuprates, okay? And so, if you try to move this electron from side to side, that would be equivalent of basically going disproportionate configuration D8 and D8 double ligand hold. That's how the propagation of the electron occurs. And of course, it gives you immediately two nickel sites with nickel 1 and nickel 2. One is a very covalent with two holes on that and a spin 0 because those two holes will couple to this D8 configuration antiferromagnetically. Really very similar to what you would think of Zangreis physics. D8 will be highly ionic site with the high spin state. Okay, and then they said that's the true ground state of this material, perhaps, and the antiferromagnetism is very, very peculiar in this configuration, so the charge order, of course, here occurs in the checkerboard pattern, and the antiferromagnetism is very interesting, so in the pseudocubic settings, it's going to be along this diagonal, and the configuration within the planes perpendicular to this 1-1-1 direction is going to be up, up, down, down, up, up. It's in a simple, naive configuration proposed at time. So the things become more and more complex now. So I'll briefly take you through the proofs of those ground states, and then I'll shortly show that some of the things are quite incorrect. So the first experiment is there any charge order? Yeah, there is. And if you look at the X-rays, they show they show that the bond angles are just decreasing, and it jumps suddenly above certain transition temperature. It's a monoclinic phase. There are two non-equivalent nickel sites. Those two sites, after magnetic diffraction scattering, would have two very different magnetic moments, exactly like Chomsky and Mizukawa Zawadzki predicted. They have two Nicoian magnetic moments, Domann-McLean distortion spectrum. So far, it looks great. Is there any charge order according to X-rays? We can tune to the nickel K edge. And this is above transition, this is resonance scattering, but once you go below the magnetic the metal to insulating transition, also you have two nickel sites. There's a two sites on nickel pops out. And so it's beautiful, you can feed this data to charge ordered pattern. Everything looks great, and there is also magnetic order coinciding with charge order and in niobium nickelate. So far so good, so we have charge order. Now, is there any Lorentz asymmetry go through MIT? Yes, there is. You can do the Raman, and there is a symmetry break, and when you go through MIT in this material, here's the Raman shift at about 440 inverse wave numbers. There's a new peak occurs going to Raman, and it could be really fitted all the phonons to specific symmetries. Okay, these are the first sort of shocking result came as the argument against charge order. This group of people did a very, very careful neutron diffraction studies, and then it turned out, according to their refinement on niobium, praseodymium, and niobium nickelate, all the moments on nickel sites are the same. So there are no two magnetic and non-equivalent nickels. It's a very recent work, about 3 or 4 years ago, with collaborators. They went through the whole series of the whole family and actually measured the magnetic electronic properties. And what they came to the conclusion, they say, well, we conclude that the electronic structure change remains very, very small within the series. So the MIT changed very dramatically. Metal to insulating transition temperatures, electronic properties, you know, even there are different phases occur. And yet, if that's the charge of perfectionation, it doesn't change. It's all the same. It doesn't matter what members of the family look. So that's very, very suspicious. But I will summarize it. So what people think, they think when you go to this ground state of this material, you're going to go through MIT, either here or there, and you're going to lower the symmetry to monoclinic. You're going to gain the charge order in the insulating phase of this particular space group, and you'll get antiferromagnetism of this type. That's what drives the metal to insulating transition. Okay. So that's the bulk. What's the problem? The problem is fundamental. There are no single crystals. In these materials, whatever we learned so far, is there is only single crystals of lanthanum nickelate in the bulk. Everything else is powder. And it immediately limits, there are no samples larger than 50 microns in size. Okay? Everything is powder. Whatever we learned so far was done on the powder. Oops, I'm sorry. Okay, so the only option is really is the thin films, and that's why there was no work done before. And I'd like to sort of point out there are at least three groups in my mind who extensively studied. There was like a wonderful amount of work conducted right on this web this site with Susan Stemmer leading the effort. There was a Murray, I believe, right, on that topic. Bernard Keimer has really contributed quite a bit, especially in terms of the magnetism in thin films and synthesis of praseodymium nickelate super lattices. And Ramanathan from Harvard, he focused on oxide electronics as a devices. So he put quite a bit of effort in physics of devices related to nickelates. So it's really a very interesting topic, and so let me show to you what's new about that. First of all, the quality could be very, very high. This is sort of like advertisement for the quality of films we can reach today. But I'd like to show you something new, what we learn. First of all, if you go to the very, very thin limit, you can gain, this is the phase diagram for films, and you can immediately see it's very, very different from the bulk. So the new things here is you can notice there is a wonderful, interesting non-Fermi liquid phase. Once you compress this film, it becomes a non-Fermi liquid. And it has very, very peculiar power exponents. For example, in the higher temperatures, in a quite extended range, it's actually like it incorporates. It's T. Very linear. I can actually take a ruler and run through that, and it will be a T. And then it really switches, and the fourth third is not like imagination. This is really just derivative. It's really fourth third. It's 1.33333. So it's really fourth third. And then, if you keep compressing this further, it actually switches again. Really switches, like 2 5-thirds. Again, this is not a feat. We just take second derivatives and just run it on your axis, and that's the number you're going to get.
How many times a decade is?
Where?
Like, these powers are like how many decades?
Oh, that's the point where it crosses. So this is the sort of the crossing temperature, and it, all the way from here, so.
So 2 decades?
Well, roughly from 150 to 10, of to 1.5 Kelvin, yeah. So, and the T is actually goes pretty, pretty high. And by the way, it breaks the Yoffe-Rogel limit as well. You can heat it up and it doesn't saturate. Very, very peculiar. Another interesting thing, this phase in the paramagnetic insulating phase does not exist in the bulk either. But what's interesting in my mind here is like what really drives this diversity? Why this train is so dramatically sensitive to this physics? And the idea came from Daniel Comsky. He even put in his books where he proposed the idea. It's actually this is the Zengreis state. So once you have a hole, right? Once you have a hole in oxygen, which is coupled to nickel, you can think about that your Fermi edge physics all coupled or pinned to this particular state. And what you do with the compressive and tensile strain, you just basically raise this level, the Zengreis level, up and down, and you just reach different phases by doing that. And so what I'm showing to you, if the only direct way to look at the hole is really to look at the oxygen KH absorption spectroscopy. This is really a hole, the nickel-oxygen hybridization peak, and that's basically what how people knew that when you dock the hole into the cuprates, where does it go? So it's not residing on copper, it resides on oxygen. The same thing is here. See, it gives this gigantic pre-peak in the spectroscopy. You can see it very, very pronounced, and it has a wonderful evolution with strain. So that's basically evolution of your hole state with strain. And it's sort of the summary when you integrate it. This is the peak position. So it shifts when you go through the increasing strain. This is compressive. This is tensile. And the peak width is really dramatically evolves. About it's really a huge number. It's almost 0.1 EV per percent of strain. So this seems to me the prediction what Comsky suggested that this is the state where it's called the self-doping. So this is the doping. It looks like you dop cuprates with the holes, but there is no need to dop nickelates. You just basically could do the same physics with strain.
What information do you get from the width?
The width, it's the amount of hybridization. It's the bandwidth, you know. It's a TPD, if you wish to. If to be precise, this is a projected on oxygen density of states, if you want to. So if you calculate in your LDA, it will be an oxygen projected density of states. That's what you see. And that will be a Fermi edge in the projection. Here is the bulk. Because if you think, oh, okay, maybe in the bulk, so we run through the whole series from gadolinium nickelate to lanthanum nickelate, and there is nothing. The bulk does not show similar evolution. With the rarer ions, so people think it's like chemical pressure. So you just change the ion, you know, a side ion. No, it doesn't. Not at all. In fact, you know, it remains constant going through the whole series. Okay. So let me just go. Then, what's the nature of MIT? First of all, there are no single crystals, and nobody actually ever measured the thing. Is there any charge order? And really, not in the powder. Is there any charge order? Is there any E prime antiferromagnetism? We need to have single crystals to do it. So we start here. And what are we going to do now? We synthesize these films. And here's the first answer. Is there any charge order in europium nickelate? And so what do we do here? If you remember the bulk, this is the film now. It's a really the first single crystal film available for that. It's a 6 nanometer single domain film. This is transitions for this film. And as you can see, we go into to the base temperatures. Okay. And we immediately see two nickel sites. There is a beautiful charge disproportionation. There are two non-equivalent nickels. There is monoclinic symmetry in this crystal. Yes, indeed. Even in the ultra-ultra-thin limit, you can still see their beautiful charge order. Okay.
So what's the spectrum?
This is the resonance. So what are we doing here? Let me just maybe, it's a good question. Maybe I should stop a little bit here. So if you take a metallic phase of this material and you do resonance scattering in one particular Bragg reflection, 105, because the nickels are equivalent in our trombic unit cell, the contribution to scattering comes only from neodymium or europium from A site and oxygen. So this gives you some sort of background. But nickel does not contribute, so we'll see just basically a straight line. But once you broke the symmetry, it goes to monoclinic phase, there are two non-equivalent nickels, there should be charge ordered or any kind of non-equivalent nickels, then nickel would immediately contribute. Because in our atomic phase, basically those two nickels, they cancel out in structure factor. It's just zero, gives you zero. But once it's in monoclinic phase, there are two non-equivalent nickels, then they immediately start contributing to scattering. And that's what you see here. All of a sudden, you have shoots up. The signal is very, very large. And the enhancement comes from the fact that I tune to the nickel K edge. This is a resonant thing. So what you're looking here is the resonance scattering at one particular Q vector where nickel in our thrombic phase would not contribute, but in the monoclinic low temperature phase does.
That's a Bragg peak or a forbidden Bragg peak?
It's a forbidden Bragg peak for metallic phase. But in insulating phase, the symmetry, if the symmetry is broken, it have a very, very strong contribution. And you have two peaks that are two different nickels. Okay. Right. So, okay, that confirms that it does have it. And the second thing, is there any antiferromagnetism? So I'm showing to you, we tune to this E prime antiferromagnetism along this Q. And we measure this thing. The first beautiful thing, of course, there is a signal, and there's a beautiful temperature dependence on that. Yes, indeed, it's E prime, as was predicted by Komsky, Zawadzki, Misakawa. It's E prime antiferromagnetism. Okay, so beautiful. So what we established here by doing this scattering, even on this four magnetic unit cell film, it's so thin, it's just four magnetic unit thing. We still can get beautiful signals, and we established for the first time on the single crystal that, yes, indeed, antiferromagnetism E prime does exist in this material. It has charge order and a monoclinic symmetry change growing across MIT, even in the film. Okay, so we are so excited. So now we're going to this neodymium nickelate. And we're doing this thing. So first of all, I'm showing to you that this is resistivity. So it really goes through MIT, as it should be. It's about 150 Kelvin. And this is the answer, basically, for you here. So is there any magnetism? Yes, indeed, right? And that temperature, we have a beautiful E prime antiferromagnetism. And it shows to you, see, there is no antiferromagnetism above in metallic phase here. There is no magnetic ordering. And of course, there is a beautiful magnetic ordering at 20 Kelvin. And that's the temperature dependence, which coincides with that thing. So it is really firmly established that even neodymium nickelate now, we have beautiful E prime antiferromagnetism. What about charge order? Again, remember what you do. You go to this, what's called the forbidden peak, where you should not see anything from nickel if the nickel is too equivalent, because the structure factors, they come with the ones with the positive sign, now with negative, they just cancel out each other. And that's in the atomic phase, so we tune to this. As you can see, this signal, this level only comes from neodymium and oxygen. That's basically your level. Nickel does not contribute in atomic phase. And then, to our shock and surprise, we took the temperature dependence through this, where the forbidden reflection should shoot up if it's charge orders, or if the symmetry change of the crystal, and there is nothing. There is no change. You go through MIT, that's 150 Kelvin, you know there is an antiferromagnetic that sits in there, you know it's insulator, you know it's antiferromagnetic, and there is no change in the symmetry, either is symmetry, or there are two non-equivalent nickels in the system. We decided maybe we're not very sensitive here. Let's tune to the specific energy. And so this is the resonance scattering. This is non-resonant. This is resonance scattering at 20 Kelvin. And as you can see, this is only neodymium and oxygen. There are no two horn pattern, nothing. We are so shocked by that that we decided, do we see the nickel at all? Because maybe we just screwed up on the samples. It's not a single sample, by the way. We run like six of them, different strain and different samples. We tune to the peak, which is allowed in monoclinic phase, and you can see beautiful absorption, the different scattering. This is not the 105. This is allowed peak in the symmetry. And as you can see, yes, nickel is there. Okay, so what we have here now is the situation when you have antiferromagnetism in the system, you have no charge order and no symmetry change, and yet you have MIT. So the system remains orthorhombic with MIT and without any charge order on nickel.
Could it be a short range order or something? You need like exaps to prove that there's no local distortion.
Yeah, we have exaps done on that too. Yeah, so the exap, it depends on fitting too, right? But exaps change, no change basically going across MIT. Exap is very sensitive to Bunge's proportionation, right?
Is there any PDF
That you have to remember, this is like 4 nanometer thick film. So whatever sees here is only possible with these X-rays. You know, the amount of work you can do in that very limited, right? So you cannot do neutron refinement, you cannot do anything like that. So no, the answer is no. Okay, so now here's the interesting thing, because if you just go back to classics, what I found peculiar, because I actually read on the internet, strangely enough, a comment from Leon Balanz. What is the Mott transition in Mackenzie blog? You know, it was about the Mott transition. So, but anyways, I'll go by the Mott's book. Okay. So he said the reason you have this MIT in the pure Mott transition, you have to have preformed magnetic moments. I'm not trying to embarrass you.
The internet is dangerous.
This is dangerous. I would say no. The dangerous thing, we're reading the same blog. You know, that's the bad thing. So Ross McKenzie's blog. You know, like that's the thing. But it's the only one, by the way, I read. You know.
While you're on the internet.
Okay. So anyway, what's important according to Mott, you have to have preformed magnetic moments, right? Once you go through MIT, that's a strong correlation between those spin, the magnetic moments, that should be there. So to me, it was a very interesting statement because I read it several times, and I said, okay, well, that's a very interesting question. Is there any magnetic moment in the metallic phase? Okay, it's not ordered, but is there any magnetic moment, uncompensated magnetism? Okay, it's not ordered. So we went through that, and we measured XMCD. It's just the magnetism, uncompensated magnetism on nickel. And this is the answer. This is above MIT. This is below MIT. The moment is exactly the same. There are moments. They sit in there all the time. Okay? So in one case, they go long-range order. And another thing, but the magnitude, they're there.
Field, you have zero field?
No.
This is 5 Tesla. This is 5 Tesla. Yeah, this is 5 Tesla field.
It's a net moment.
Yes, it's on nickel, nothing else. And this is how I found very, very peculiar that in Bose phases above MIT and below MIT, we do have magnetic moments and they do order. So in other words, I know like people say, oh yeah, but what's it's like, you know, Slater antiferromagnetism. But if it's Slater, again, if we read the same books, you would know that it's basically the magnetic moment just occurs at TNL. It does not exist in the metallic phase. Okay, it's not the same at all.
So how does one really conclude? I'm not doubting it, I'm just trying to understand. So how do you ever get to the conclusion of XMCD that there is a local moment? Couldn't it be why has to be a local moment? There's a moment on nickel.
Yeah.
But that's induced by a magnetic field.
No, this thing is, what you're saying is correct, right? So if you have even paramagnetic right, material,
right?
And if you apply a strong enough magnetic field, you can get it. Yeah, this is absolutely correct. You're not, this is not the claim that we have magnetic moment, which is like sort of present and sitting there and trying to. So the way you study them, then you have to take the temperature dependence, right? And so you do the temperature dependence and you do field dependence, right? So in the metallic phase, when we do temperature field dependence, there is no remnants. So you just turn off the field, and those moments, they will, the size remains the same, right? But the remnants will be gone. So that's how we know they're there, but they're not induced. And second thing is the magnitude of the moment. We know where the response of paramagnet is, just size of that. So this is not paramagnetic response. It's much larger than paramagnetism. There is another thing, and a paper will come out. Actually, we actually made the further claim. We analyzed these line shapes. And actually, this is the real S equals 1 line shape. That's how the, if you go to DA, DA double ligand hole, this is D8. This is weird. This is S equals 1 magnetism. The line shape is exactly S equals 1 magnetism. So we did Cramer's chronic from scattering and from absorption. This is exactly D8 line shape of this magnetism.
Can you have a single one in all nickel sites? Can
No, you can't. Yeah, then it's not going to be nickel 3 plus, right?
So,
yeah. But it's nickel 3 plus. We know that from spectroscopy. Precisely, no, it's 3 plus.
So you have some statement on the magnitude of the
of
average
this,
moment nickel?
No.
Static moment
no.
In this 5 Tesla field?
We can't. No. I only can tell that this the as a response, right? The response function for this is S equals 1 response. It's not S equals 1 half.
You cannot measure susceptibility.
How do you tell that? Sorry.
What you can do, you can take your scattering, right? So for S equals the nickel oxide, right? So it's a 2 plus S equals 1 classic system, right? And if you do XMCD, you will get exactly that's how it's going to look like. Exactly like that. If you do scattering and you do Cramer's chronic, you get exactly this line shape from nickel oxide. So you take your best S equals 1 system, and that's how it's going to behave. So to me, it's a very interesting, it's not entirely solved things. I'm just saying this is a very interesting thing to think of. Okay, maybe it's not that wrong what they were saying. That's how the charge is proportionates in D8, which is supposed to be S equals 1. And I'm looking at nickel, right? So this is nickel edge. I'm really looking at nickel, not oxygen.
That was a good question, George.
Can you measure susceptibility of the single field?
Most likely, it would be meaningful if you had thicker films. But I'll show it to you. There is a big thing. You know, if I make the film thicker, going to the bulk-like, that will have a charge order and everything as intended. This is only exists when you, and I will say this word right now, when you freeze the phonon modes. Actually, in this film, all the tilts and rotations have been frozen by the epitaxial relation to substrates. What we've done here, remove the phonons. We don't allow the system now to, we remove basically, to be specific, if anybody's an expert, it's a vibrational, oxygen vibrational mode. The rattling of oxygen has been frozen here. Okay, most likely. Okay, so at least that's the indication we have. Okay, if you say, okay, well, that's great, but how can we explain then the evolution from, the metal to acetylene transition from MIT point of view? If it's all electronic, Mott Hubbert, why that should evolve then with rare earth side ion, which is not clear, right? If you do LDA, you know that niobium doesn't mix. It's much higher energies in perovskites than, you know, far away from Fermi edge, and so why would it matter? And here's the answer. So we just get it published. We've done RIX, you know, this resonant elastic scattering. That's a very, very interesting way to look at your materials. And let me show to you what can you learn from that. First of all, we did the RIX on, it's a resonant inelastic X-ray scattering. So this is specific absorption we're looking at. And we're looking at the tensile case. So first of all, we see in RIX, that's the energy loss, that's an inelastic basically peak, it's a direct RIX process. If anybody wants to know more about RIX, I would be more than happy sort of explain what we measure. But the important thing is that you see two peaks here, and one of this peak is associated with this orbital, Dx squared minus 1. Another one is that. And above metals and centrifuges, they are roughly the same intensity. Okay. And then when you cool through MIT, all of a sudden the intensity of this peak, Dx squared minus y squared, drops down. And that tells you that this, since it's a nickel site, right? So since the intensity drops down, then this thing is losing, this thing is starting losing electrons, this state. Okay. Now, where this electron goes, and that was the biggest mystery for us, because we knew that from the nickel sites, you know, that there is a change in the spectral weight when you go through MIT, so we lose in electrons. But we never could tell. We saw some change on oxygen edge, so we always thought, okay, maybe the hole is migrating between oxygen and nickel back and forth. But this is the first time when we found it.
Excuse me.
Yes.
So at high temperatures, you claim that they are equally populated?
Yes, you could say that, yes.
And why then, there are two peaks?
And that's because there is a, in the crystal field, right? So once you do a tensile, there is a splitting, right?
Yeah, but if I split, why they are equally populated?
Well, they're not quite equal, right? So that's your splitting here. So it's about, electronically, it's going to be about 0.4 eV here in this. It's a structural, by the way.
So those are final states.
Those are final states.
In the elastic, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
But they're not populated in the ground state, right?
No, we're not looking at the ground state. This is the final state process. Right. But let me just explain maybe. I need to go and show to you what the Rick's process look like. Maybe if you allow me to skip on that. But the lesson we learned here, there's a big change in intensity. Yes.
So why specifically was this not at the KX? Because you would say LH is much better if you look at the nickel.
Yeah, I wish I could, right? That's going like experiments always justify backwards, right? So that's the access we had the beam lines, right? So we look at the structural things essentially. It's correct. Yeah, so LH is coming, you know, this fall, and actually in October it's coming. Yeah, that's absolutely correct. So this is the structural. So what we're looking at is the distortions in terms of structure. But still, it fits back in, of course, in the orbital physics, right? But the important thing here, we found that the first time we found, so we tuned to the neodymium now. So this is not nickel or oxygen. We tuned to the neodymium. And to our biggest surprise, I don't know why we never look at that, we actually found this missing spectral weight on the neodymium edge. So this is the room temperature versus 7K. This is the difference in the absorption on the neodymium. Okay, and so if you just integrate the things and look carefully at the things, that looks like it's very suggestive, at least to me, that this spectral weight, so that electron, is actually being rubbed off by nickel. So that's basically the observation. I think I need to still swallow that things, but what it tells me that the charge transfer here, in other words, there is a d-d coupling, right? So there are d states, okay, 5d states and neodymium, and there are of course d states and nickel, and so there is a hopping. There is a finite hopping. It is small, but it's a finite hopping between this d-d. There's t-d-d matrix element, seems to me, that thing. So what it tells us is it's not the physics between oxygen and nickel as we thought all the time, but it seems to me neodymium, the A side, is really the controlling the amount of charge between which is distributed on the bond between nickel and oxygen. And by basically changing the ionic radius, right, you can modify the Madelung potential, for example, on the sides at least. And then that's the result where the hole is basically migrating, and so the charge transfer gap opens or closes, depends on how much modeling you change with the rare ion. Okay. That's the sort of working hypothesis. It's a question to what Leon raised in the beginning. I really don't know. Maybe you would be correct, right, if it's similar physics, what I said. So the claim was, hey, say here we have a Mott transition, right, not the Slater transition. I know only two cases. The one is on the surface of strontium-2 ruthenium-04, where the surface freezes the the phonon modes. Exactly the same thing. Here's the interface freezes phonon modes. There is a surface. There are sort of tilts. They are not allowed on the surface. Plummer's group did quite careful work using lead, basically, to refine what happens on the surface. They claim it's a pure electronic mode transition. Another case we aware of is the if you take vanadium 203, you dope with chromium, there will be like a pure electronic MIT, but this is with doping, right? So as I said, maybe my statement is a bit more precise. I say I know of only the surface case and the doped case, but I don't know anyone with the temperature in the bulk. And here we got 15 unit cells, so it's a bulk like crystal.
I don't know. I mean, there's Catenon 2.
Yeah, I'd like to hear more.
7, which is. Okay.
So it's just words, MOTS, slater, all that.
Yeah.
If we just forget the words, it's right. Like metal insulator transition without structure change.
Right. Is there any magnetism in the metallic phase? You know,
yeah.
That's the question.
Yeah,
is there? Yeah. So right. It has to be something.
Oh, in the metallic phase.
Yeah.
No,
that what that's important, right?
I don't know. What do you mean?
Well, doesn't go. But
what does it mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, as I said,
transition at which there is a metal insulator transition coinciding with a magnetic ordering.
Right. Yeah, but that's not doubling your brilliant zone or anything.
No,
this is
no.
Yeah. So I'd like to hear. Yeah, as I said, I'm not going to argue with the theorist what is mod, what's later, but this is what I'd like to know more. You know, like I'd like to see a case with the temperature where this occurs. Okay. So those are two papers. If you'd like to read a little bit more, this is just appeared very recently in PRL. This we just put on the ConMed, so you can look at the questions here. Okay, so now since we are in the spin orbit, and that's what I would say, I want to show you something which you perhaps heard many, many times, but this is the experimental realization of that. So everybody knows this. Why is it interesting, right? Perhaps the most simple thing here is to start with the right lattice symmetry.
We have 7 minutes, including discussion.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'll make it. Yeah. Because this is the part where it's very easy story. Okay. This is graphene, and I don't have to convince you that the graphene lattice is important. The particular symmetry C3V is very, very important, found in molecular compounds around many materials in molecules. Very, very rare in the solid material. Solid, in fact, I'm not aware about any solid state materials with C3V symmetry like this. And then basically what you need to create is the last lattice geometry, then you can go and do your band structure, and maybe you can end up with the direct dispersion, and maybe something interesting will occur. What to me, the very interesting point was when this group, Nagaos and Satoshi Akimoto and other authors, they proposed an alternative route to this. As a physicist, this is much more valuable. So what they said, we can do it now. We can engineer those phases, the topological with quantum, for example, Hall effects. If you could take a perovskite and look in the 1-1-1 direction, and then what you're going to end up. If you keep looking at that and you're a little bit clever and you imagine 2 unit cells, right, of this material, just take a perovskite, 2 unit cells, look along 1-1-1, and if you just careful enough, you will see that makes a buckled honeycomb lattice. That makes a buckled honeycomb lattice, 2 unit cells of perovskite in 1-1-1 direction. And so what you could do perhaps, and then you could do a lot of magic doing theory, then you can end up with interesting topological quantum phases. And unfortunately, this paper, surprisingly, they did not propose anything coming out of interactions. Still, every example they gave here had the real spin orbit. So this is the materials they proposed. Another question, of course, the theorist, where you've seen those, except for this. They don't exist in nature, even in the bulk. But anyway, it's interesting to think of. As in the, sort of the case. Right, the next step to me was very important when Greg Feed's group and the group Yin Ran they look at the same system, but when they say, can you make the same result, the same topological phases, the quantum anomalous Hall phases, without explicit spin orbit, it still will come out as a virtual term, but it, in this particular case, they call interacting topological phases, and there was a proposal to take a lantum nickelate and make two unit cells of those and look at the long 111, and this is the phase diagram they proposed. Okay, so to me it was inspirational enough to try this. And I'd like to say a few words about this, why theorists like to do it and why we sort of had the delay in the answer. The major problem here is when somebody tells you to grow something in 111, is to realize it's the worst growth direction for any material scientist, because this is strontium titanate in 001. This is the same strontium titanate in 111. And if you just look at the polar jump between atomic planes here, it goes like this, plus 4, minus 4, plus 4, minus 4. Whereas in this direction, it's a zero atomic, the charge per plane, zero, zero, zero. So if you ask me to grow the thing on something like has zero charge in the surface, for example, and then you try to layer this structure on the top with the plus minus 4 charge jump, there will be what's called now the polar catastrophe. In other words, you build up a potential so quickly, it's about tens of EVs per unit cell typically, then it'll basically blast your material, metallizing the basically thing. You put the linear huge potential on top of your bent structure, and you know that pretty soon it's going to be non-insulating material. So this thing is very, so nature would never allow you to do that. It will try to reconstruct in some way. So what we, it's a typical example when you grow in lanthanum aluminate, for example, there is no polar jump here. But then when you grow in strontium titanate, there will be gigantic polar jump here. So I'm going to skip this, but let me tell you, we spent like about a year learning how to do it properly. And now we have two recipes, not even one, two recipes, how to grow these perfect films. And this is the example of this, your hexagonal structure. Realize it's a cross-section, basically what you see here as a TM with yields work done in our collaboration in Academy of Sciences in China. So basically, those are two unit cells of your material, of lanthanum nickelate, layered in 111 direction. Then we have four unit cells of lanthanum aluminate here to make it two-dimensional. You have to keep it two-dimensional, right? It has to be graphene-like. So it's a single graphene-like with the buckled bonds, right? So that's what it is. And so we can layer it like 10 to 15 times, this kind of thing, structure. Okay. Without being reconstructed or without dirty chemistry occurring in the material and so on and so forth. Okay, so we're now very excited because I would like to show you how dramatically different life to be when you do lattice engineering. So if you go to this, that's your proposed phase diagram versus this is what's in the perovskite phase, exactly the same material.
Axes have no relation to one another.
Huh? What's that?
The axes have no relation to one another.
No.
Absolutely true. You know, because this is the ground state, right? So if you look at the ground state, it should be here. Right? So that's the only relevant parameter, right? So, well, you know, the best part is that that's experimental. This is the theoretical, right? So
if you make the double layer, then you'll break the symmetry that is... you have different bonds going in and out of the plane, basically, right?
It's basically like this.
Yeah. So that will give you... Is there a difference in the nickel-oxygen directions in the three different directions?
No. It depends on what you started material, right? So if you start with cube, of course, that goes well, right? If you start with anything lower symmetry, then you start being careful, yeah. Yeah, there is, of course, then they will start breaking. But okay, that's sort of short answer. Yeah, the symmetry of a starting thing matters a lot. Yeah, absolutely, very, very good observation, yeah.
Yeah. Can you find any ferromagnetic phases?
I'll show it to you. That's in the remaining 2 minutes, I'm gonna show it to you, yeah. So this is the thing. So you have to find ferromagnetism. To find topological phase, find ferromagnetism. Here's the answer for those of you who wants to do it. So this is the magnetism. We just went again tuned to nickel, and this is your magnetism versus magnetic field. And if it's a ferromagnet, you know, then you should have remnants, right? When you remove magnetic field, right? If you can see here, the answer is no ferromagnetism. Okay? Now we take the same thing and do the temperature dependence. This is temperature dependence of magnetic response. That's your squid, basically, versus temperature. And then if we plot it properly, right, 1 over T, that immediately shows to you that system has antiferromagnetic correlations. Now, if you now look at your phase diagram, right? I'm not saying phase diagram is correct, but I'm saying that that's the easiest way to check for us. And this is the thing. And we also did the orbital ordering, and it's actually orbitally ordered system. And so our claim is that it's the system with antiferromagnetic correlation and antiferro orbital ordering. So what we need is much, much better theory and many more of these experimental systems to try that. But we have a tool now. For the first time, I can place basically, you know, perovskites are abandoned. I can place now ions at the choice. And so in that, I can see, I'd like to say this. This is suggestive. As I said, it's an inspirational thing. So since we can put now these ions at will, right, we can start looking at, as I said, this is very inspirational. It's not even a phase diagram. But it's very nice that you can look at the things and at least conjecture the possibility for interesting phases here without explicit spin-orbit interaction, an atomic spin-orbit interaction. And that I'd like to, so I'll skip my collaborators. Dollars are very important, they're listed there. But I'd like to sort of really show my group that this is the, I'm basically most of the time a voice of those people, right? So this is the very, very talented group of people who've done amazing work. And what I reported today is like done by those two personalities mostly. The Derek Mayers, he's now in Brookhaven, that's 2 weeks from now. He's moving to Brookhaven and will be a Riggs man. And Sriman Tamidi, he's done this 111 work, so he developed the growth and the experimentation. So, on that, I would like to stop and thank you.
We had a few questions during the talk, and if you have any urgent question, we can take it.
I'd like to hear questions, you know, like. It's most important for us to experience, to hear the questions, you know.
Yeah, but, you know.
A quick one.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that there's a quantum critical point in the phase diagram. Can you...
a very, very good point, right? So it's... The same work was done on the bulk, right? People applied pressure. And what they saw very similar bar exponents developing. And so we cannot tune it, right? So we can only jump across. And unfortunately, the first jump according to point 3. So there, I cannot cross along zero. But it doesn't matter how hard we tried, right? It's like very, very to the left on tensile side, always had insulating phase. And we go like very small amount of strain on the compressive, and it's immediately metallic. It's crazy metallic phase. So we only conjectured that. And everything else came from theory. There is a theory in that paper, Greg Feet and developed the theory saying that behavior reminds him like it's approaching of 2D, in 2D materials, quantum criticality with the antiferromagnetic background. Now, I'm aware that Jim Allen here also is working on a similar sort of notion that they think there is a quantum critical point in the system from transport point of view. So that's as much as I can comment on that. So we cannot prove or disprove it because the strain is, it cannot tune across zero. Yeah. Yeah, because you really need to get the resistivity really under control, right, as a function of that. But that's the thing.
I don't doubt your results, it looks very convincing, but I remember a few years back there were similar or maybe same material, another experiment, maybe Kentucky group like Gankow's, I'm not sure. I can look it up, and they found semi quality was bad, but I think they found ferromagnetism. That's why also Craig kind of focused on these ferromagnetic phases. So
right.
Are you aware of these works, or can you?
No, I'm not. I actually don't worry about this work. But as it comes to ferromagnetism, we are very, very confident about this. You know, like this ferromagnet is so easy to pick up, right? And And those films, you know, they've been characterized to death. You know, this really, I wish it could be there. Actually, I would be much more excited to see the antifa. And the second thing, to my mind, to my knowledge, this 111 girls, actually, we're the first who done this system. I'm not aware about the other. If somebody's done, I'd like to hear, because we need to cite properly. Right?
So, Jacques will be here for the rest of the week, and I suggest we move to the second talk and send Jacques again.